So we are on, I thought this was question number 6, right? I think it is. It could be 5, but I couldn't remember because I haven't done it in a while and I don't have my dad's notes. So for those of you just joining us, which I think is for this series, Eric and Isabel, we have been doing a series of Bible studies and topical studies on apologetics, just different questions that people have about the Christian faith and just having a reasonable answer and a biblical answer about these things. So several weeks ago we talked about science and how there are certain questions that science can't answer, even though people want to say that they base their life on science. Some people do. Most of us realize, and even some unsaved people realize, that there are a lot of questions that science just doesn't have the answer to. But then last week we specifically began to look at the topic of evolution. So I put just one simple verse on your handout tonight. It's Exodus chapter 20. And it's verse number 11. Excuse me. Exodus 20:11. Bible says, well, let's just read it together out loud. Ready? For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. So last week we saw really the biblical case for why the concept of evolution and Christianity, as far as a biblically based Christianity, they're really incompatible, even though a lot of Christians and some good people have tried to mesh them, have tried to make it work somehow where we can have evolution and God involved in that whole process. The Bible really doesn't allow for such a thing to take place. And anyone that tries to do that is really, what we talked about last week, is really trying to make the Bible suit a modern viewpoint rather than understanding the world and the origin of the world through what the Bible says. So we spoke biblically last week and said, hey, you really look at all these scriptures, you really cannot fit the evolutionary concept of millions and millions of years with the biblical account. They don't square. But then that begs the question, though. And that question is, well, but what about these scientific claims? What about the scientific claims of evolution and, as is common belief today, that the earth is not millions, but I believe now we're up to 4.5 billion years. I'm not sure. Is that where we're at? We've reached 4.5 billion. And I believe that's been extended. But common viewpoint. So if you were to ask somebody, if you were to pick up any children's book, you pick up any children's book and they've got dinosaurs on the front, right? Because what kid doesn't like dinosaurs? If you pick up any children's book about dinosaurs, probably the very first words you'll read in that children's book are millions of years ago. Millions of years ago. And it has become settled in people's minds. However, in America, the scientific community gets really rattled because to this very day, there persists in America, unlike Europe, which is very, very secular, to this very day in America, there persists a doubt and mistrust of evolution and the concept. So most people would not want to get into a debate if you ask them, is evolution a scientific fact? And that's kind of the introduction. If you ask most people, is evolution a scientific fact? There is a good number of people that would look at you and say, yes. Absolutely, it's a scientific fact. That's what they would say. However, even among people that are not Christians, you can look at the studies. What bothers evolutionists is in America, there persists a group of people that say, well, maybe, probably, I'm just not really completely sure about the whole thing. And I would only say that's because of many, many Christian organizations that exist to this very day, that are very active today, that present lots of great scientific information that actually refutes or contradicts those claims of millions and millions of years. Some of those organizations, because this whole series isn't really all about creation, we're just taking a few weeks on it. But if you want to study this more, a couple of groups that you could look at on the internet with lots of great study, if you're a science nerd, which I am not, so tonight I'm going to play some of their videos, and they'll do a better job explaining some of this than me. But some of those groups are Answers in Genesis. Those are the people that built the giant ark down in Kentucky. So Answers in Genesis is a great group that's done scientific research. And then the Institute for Creation Science, the Creation Science Institute, you can look them up, and their information is all over, and it's Institute for Creation Research, right? ICR. Their information is all over. It's really good. It's really helpful. So let's talk about some of these things, and maybe we can help you have a conversation with someone or just think through this concept. Let's have a word of prayer, and then we'll go through this. Dear Lord, we thank you for the time that you've given us to study this. I pray that you'd help us. I pray that these things would be clear. In Jesus' name, amen. So some of you have probably studied this a lot, and you could probably know everything that I'm going to say. Others of you, you may have heard about this kind of teaching, but you don't really know a lot about it. So what I want to give you tonight is just a basic groundwork for what about this? What about evolution? What about the scientific claims that the Earth is millions and millions of years old? So let's just turn the page, and we'll go right into it. Let's talk about, as we get here, let's talk about that word science, for instance. How many of you remember the science project in grade school or in middle school? How many of you remember the science project where you took a piece of bread and watched it get moldy for a few weeks or something like that and had to make a present? How many of you remember a science presentation you did? Who can remember one? Okay, Frank, what was your science presentation? The fruit flies. Okay.
And the only thing I'll tell you is that it remains fruit flies.
Okay. Fruit flies.
What about the irony of my presentation in sophomore in high school?
Sophomore in high school?
Origin of Man.
Origin of Man.
Which is why this is evolution.
Very interesting.
You got a ribbon.
You got a ribbon for it. Okay. Somebody else, who remembers the science experiment they did? This will be great. Okay. Coca-Cola, right. You watch the decay. There's a comedian that I really enjoy, and he's a clean comedian. His name is Brian Regan, and he's got a whole presentation about the science project in grammar school and about, you know, forgetting all about it until the last day. And then he shows up there, and they say, "Hey, Brian, what's your science project?" It's a cup of dirt. I call it cup of dirt. And he goes through the whole thing. It's hilarious. And then there's the other parent who did the whole thing for their kid and all that stuff. You remember how it goes. But do you remember what you were taught in school was the scientific method? Do you remember? The blanks are on there. Who remembers what the scientific method is? All right. Stephen is our only brave scientist in the room this evening. Let's see if you got it. What is the scientific method? Research.
And we have a hypothesis.
A hypothesis. We're doing great. Research, hypothesis, and?
And, it doesn't progress to a theory until it has been put up to your peers for review. They must be able to do the same experiments that you've done.
The experiment has to be replicated.
Right. It has to be repeatable.
Okay. Excellent. So, there you go. The scientific method is observation, hypothesis, and experimentation, right? That's science. That's how it works. And that's how we've come so far in our world today scientifically, because of repeated observation, lots of hypotheses were formulated, and then experiments were conducted over and over and over again. Have we seen bad science in recent years?
Yes.
Absolutely we have. In fact, the whole scare over, and I'm not, this is just a fact, the whole scare over vaccines causing autism, that was tested over and over and over and over and over again, and it was discovered that the original person was fraudulent in a lot of the presentations that he put forward. But that's why it's so important that things are increasingly experimented, tested over and over again. But when we discuss origins, as Isabel said, what is the problem with science and with this method and the discussion of origins? Nobody was there to see it, okay? So what are we observing? We're observing conditions in the present, and based on conditions in today, we are hypothesizing what? how the present conditions came to be, right? And then we are oh, no, we're not. Why not? Because you can't experiment. I know with biomedical stuff, we're doing amazing things. We're quote-unquote creating life, but we're really not creating life. What are we doing? We're taking life, and in test tubes, we're replicating life. But nobody is experimenting with, boy, let's create something from nothing. You cannot do that. So here's a keyword, and I meant to put this up. For some reason, this didn't make it onto the PowerPoint, but it's your next blank here. What we're really discussing is this. The first blank is, or maybe I didn't even blank it out. Maybe you have it. Observational, do you have that?
No.
Okay, I underlined it. There you go. Filled in the blank for you. So what we're really looking at is observational science as opposed to historical science, right? Ken Ham, who is getting ready to do another debate with Bill Nye the Science Guy, if you follow that stuff, he's geared up for round two, which has been great because the publicity. In fact, a lot of evolutionists are upset with Bill Nye because they think that Bill Nye is giving too much publicity to Ken Ham and all his creationist views. But I believe this spring they're having round two debate, or maybe this fall. Anyhow, he'll talk a lot about the difference between observational science and historical science. In fact, let me let them introduce that whole concept to you right now.
Have you ever heard this? Billions of years ago, there was an explosion in space. Or 100,000 years ago, this happened or that happened. Or even in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Question, how does anyone know? I mean, was anybody there to observe it? Well, actually, somebody was, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Check this out. First of all, we need to recognize that there is a huge difference between observational science and historical science. Both are valuable, but very different. Let's define the two real quick, shall we? Observational science is simply when we observe something and experiment to draw conclusions. It involves repeatable experimentation and observations in the present. It's through observational science that we find cures for diseases and build space shuttles, stuff like that. Now, through historical science, we consider things that happened in the past, but they cannot be checked in the same way. I mean, we don't have access to the past like we do the present because, well, it's gone, right? All we really have is speculation, or at best, circumstantial evidences of past events based on what we see in the present. That's not to say that we can't make intelligent guesses about the past or form reasonable inferences from rocks or fossils in the present, but we certainly cannot directly test our conclusions because we cannot repeat the past. Got it? So, does that mean historical science is unimportant? Not at all. Let's drop an example down here for a minute and take a look at the Eiffel Tower. You know, that 19th century Parisian monument designed by Gustav Eiffel that stands 1,063 feet tall, which was built as the entrance for the 1889 World's Fair, and is still the tallest building in Paris today, visited by millions of people each year? Yeah, that one. Well, guess what? Everything I just told you was true, but how do we test it? Well, applying observational science, we can, of course, observe the Eiffel Tower anytime we're in Paris. It's here in the present. Then, we can continue by testing the height and comparing it to all the other structures in Paris and confirm the claim that it is indeed the tallest building in Paris. But that's the extent of the kind of facts that can be proved by observational science in reference to this claim. How do we really know that Gustav designed it? How do we really know it was built in the 19th century as an entrance to the 1889 World's Fair? How do we really know how many people visited? That's all in the past. It can't be repeated. For that kind of information, we need to go outside the limits of observational science and discover what has been communicated to us through historical documents and eyewitness accounts. And furthermore, we have to believe those eyewitnesses and documents are trustworthy. The same is true when we talk about the origin of the Earth. The Earth is here. We all agree with that. So, does observational science confirm that the world was created by God? And are there trustworthy documents and eyewitness accounts that confirm it? But let's take the last part first. In short, what we're really asking is my original question, was anybody there to observe it? The answer is, yes. God was there, and he told us how he created. He inspired people to write down his very words that became books that were compiled into a complete book called the Bible, which has been verified over and over again and has demonstrated itself to be totally trustworthy in all it claims and teaches. Even secular scholars will concede that the Bible accurately records historical events. Anyway, we have the most trustworthy revelation from the most trustworthy eyewitness. Now, what about observational science? Does it confirm the Bible? Yes. And what's extremely important to realize is the observable fact that the universe is logical and orderly. That makes sense only if its creator is logical and has imposed order on his creation. It doesn't make sense at all if the universe is just an accident of a huge explosion. Also, our minds are able to comprehend many things about the universe, and that's only possible if the creator of the mind gave us the ability and desire to explore the universe. It doesn't make sense if our brains are byproducts of chance because we couldn't trust their conclusions to ever be accurate. And lastly, it only makes sense that we can observe and repeat an experiment if the universe consistently obeys the same laws from day to day, which only makes sense if a lawgiver created it that way and upholds it. So to be bluntly honest, science itself, whether observational or historical, is only possible because God exists and the Bible is true. I could go on, but enough said.
To get his last point there, we talked about that in our first lesson about science. And that was the one we were all kind of looking at each other like, what are we talking about? But the whole point is, Deborah's laughing at me. Thank you, hon. The whole point is that the irony of the evolutionary concept is that we're an accidental random mutation that arrived here. So then how can you even trust your own rational understanding of the past? Right? It doesn't even, how can you trust your mind when you don't even know where your mind came from or if it's reliable? That's more philosophical as opposed to the evidence, but you got something? Were you going to say something? Okay. All right. So there's a big difference between observational historical science. Anybody got a question or comment on that real quick before we move along? Okay. Anybody? You're doing that, Frank. That confuses me.
I'm sorry.
All right. Thank you.
I have a bunch of things
I'd like to
add.
Oh. Okay. Great. So let's think about this for a minute. As we think about science, and I'd encourage you to jot some things down. I got another video or a couple of videos for you here. But when you think about theories, because we said the scientific method is it's theories, hypotheses, right? Theories all have problems, do they not? They have problems, why? Because they're necessarily wrong? Not necessarily. Theories are difficult because our understanding can be limited. So theories always have questions and problems, so what do? We look at evidence to uncover what those problems are. Now, so let's think about this. There are always, a theory always has unprovable elements to it, right? A theory, as far as in history, has an unprovable element. Can I prove to someone that God created the heavens and the earth? Evidentially, could I take evidence and prove it to them? Well, some would say yes, others would say no. I would lean toward the no. I cannot, in a scientific way, I cannot prove that to you. But in the same sense, the same burden of proof would then be on the evolutionist. Can they categorically prove to me that that's the way the universe began? Of course not. Of course they can't prove that. It's an unprovable. But therefore, all theories have an unprovable element that has to be accepted by faith. Okay? Now, your presupposition will lead to an assumption. Remember we talk a lot about presuppositions? Your presupposition will lead you to make assumptions. The video we just watched, it's a presupposition. We have the Word of God. It's been given to us. Therefore, I assume that the Word of God is true, and the data that I take in the universe around me is going to be interpreted through the lens of my presupposition. However, if I'm an evolutionist, here's the deal. Get this now. This is super important. I would write this down. Evolution needs, capital N, capital E, capital E, capital D, capital S, underlined, bold, italicized, needs there to be millions and millions of years. There has to be millions of years with evolution. I've got one video that I'm going to skip over here, and I want to move right into the problems with the evolutionary model. And what I mean by that is, why do I say evolution, capital N, capital E, capital E, capital D, capital S, exclamation, bold, why do I say evolution needs millions of years? Because we got some problems. Here are the problems. I'm going to give you three problems with evolution. They're not on the screen. Just jot them down. There has never, well, first of all, let me say this. In some sense, do things evolve? In some sense. Of course they do. Of course. In fact, that's where Darwin came up with his whole theory. We would prefer to use the word adaptations, that God has created species to adapt to situations. We see, even in the human species, I hate to call it a species, but I'm using their terms, in the human species, there are variations in skin color, and that comes from the melanin, and a lot of that has to do with where people where God ordained that people would inhabit the earth. There are all kinds of variations in species, and even you think of dogs, for instance, and how many different breeds of dogs there are. And what would happen is over the course of hundreds of years, dogs were bred for certain genetic traits to become to come to the front, and therefore you have breeds that have distinct characteristics. But what we've never, ever, ever seen, ever, 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 is we've never seen any genetic information added to a species, right? We've never seen that. There's never been, we've seen genetic information manipulated, right? The genes that those creatures have, we've seen certain genes become dominant, but we've never seen genetic information added to any species. We've also never seen any species change into another species. It has never happened. And we should never expect it to happen because the Bible says in Genesis chapter 1, let each reproduce according to what? Its own kind. Its own kind. So we're not surprised that while we see microevolution, we see creatures adapt, we never see a change in kind or species because God said that's how it would happen. So there's substantiation right there. Now, we've also never, ever, ever seen life come from non-life. We've never seen that happen. We've never seen an explosion in life come from it. And then the final one that we've never seen, we've never seen any transitional forms. Transitional forms is a fancy way to say what? Does anyone know? Missing links. The missing links. So if we've, and you remember, and my dad alluded to this briefly last week, you remember the charts that we used to see in school, Piltdown Man and all the other men, right? That's the only one I could remember right off the bat. Neanderthal, okay? And how all of that has been questioned by scientists. It's all been upended and it's no longer the way things are taught anymore. So if... Well, yeah, that's not true. Some people are still being taught that. So, but my only point quickly, though, is that the evolutionary theory is constantly being changed. If evolution is as it says it was, there should be an overwhelming number of missing links found in the fossil record. But they're not. People say, we found a bone. This is the missing link. And they create this whole creature out of a bone that they've found. So it's very disturbing, these things. But evolutionists know they have this problem. So if you have a big problem like this, like, well, we can't observe life change forms go from species to species. What's the answer for this big problem that they have? What's the answer? It's really easy. They do. But you say, but we've never seen this happen. We don't see species change. This is a pretty simple answer. It's what we're talking about tonight. Well, what? Time. Well, of course we don't see it because it takes millions and millions of years. And our concept of history, we only have recorded history of about 6,000 years, which is nothing in that time frame. So in order for the evolutionists to have security in their position, they need millions of years, because without millions of years, the theory completely falls apart. So do you think they would have a bit of a biased interest in reporting the data? Well, of course. Of course, because the whole theory requires that to be true. Therefore, you're never going to have an evolutionist. You're never going to have them say, hey, you know what? That's a good point you made there, Mr. Creationist. Great point. Let me reconsider. Maybe the Earth isn't 4 billion years old. That is never going to happen. Because if the age of the Earth isn't there for them, then the whole theory falls apart. They have to have it. Does that make sense? Right? Comment or question on that? Open it up now.
So when they look at the Earth, like layers, and they try to validate the fossils, they see land, Mars, like a cliff.
Right.
So is that what they're trying to use as an example of millions of those?
Yeah, they have several things. So a couple things really quick that you may want to research a little bit more. In school, you may have learned the geologic column, right? How you find these types of fossils in this layer, this a lot of that makes sense. Obviously, you'd have the land animals below, the birds, things like that. So some of that makes sense. However, the layers of the ages, there was a formation that they found. I forget the location, but look it up. It's very simple to find. There was a formation that was found where when they actually started digging in the rocks, they found that column completely inverted. And the species and the creatures, rather, that should have been at the bottom were at the top. And it was, in most places, it's more mixed up than that. Yeah, they found.
The whole Mount St. Helens, that was one of the points from last week, formed all of those layers in 3 days.
Yeah, I was researching that today. I'll have to look at it more. I'm not sure if it formed all those layers in 3 days. The research that I found was when Mount St. Helens erupted in 1980, they said that it would take, because of what they knew from evolution, that it would take ages for life to come back. And within a few years, everything had come back. And it did not match the length of time that they had said that it should take for that to be. I mean, I have to look at that. I didn't find that about the column. That could be true, though. But I know for a fact that the speed at which life returned to Mount St. Helens was completely contrary to what evolutionary models would have predicted that it would have been. But we see this all the time. But do you remember when BP spilled all that oil in the Gulf? And it was going to be ruined for generations. And generations and generations. Now, there's still issues there, of course, but the sea has cleaned itself remarkably. But you don't hear about any of that because that doesn't fit the storyline that the media would have us follow. So you don't hear about that. When findings like the tree that my dad just mentioned, when findings like that are discovered, they don't get the press because the scientific community as a whole, not there are many Christian scientists, but the scientific community has to preserve the concept of millions of years. They have to.
If I remember the tree, the tree was actually petrified. But it went from several different
things. So they try to preserve that even if it's alive? They preserve that even if it's alive?
Well, they don't believe that they're lying, most of them, as far as I know. I'm not to say that they are, all of these people are, you know, sneaky. They're nice people. They're good people. They're scientists. They're smart people. They're intelligent people. But they have a presuppositional way they look at the world. And they believe that evolution is true. And they're emotionally, personally, intellectually, historically vested in that belief system. So they're not going to just abandon that belief system. They're going to interpret the data that they see to fit that and say, well, we don't know. That's an anomaly. And they'll go to things on the last page here, like carbon dating. How many of you have had someone say that to you? Like, well, we know from carbon dating that the Earth is this old. You've had somebody say that, okay? Well, I'm going to show you two short videos here. You can't. So let's watch this.
You hear this one a lot. Science has proven evolution, therefore evolution is true. Since evolution is true and Christians don't believe it, then Christians don't believe... Nearly every textbook in Science magazine teaches that the Earth is billions of years old, and the primary dating method used for determining this is what is called radioisotope dating, or radiometric dating. Now, this is a reliable method for measuring absolute ages of rocks and the age of the Earth, right? Huh. First off, many scientists now regard the age of the Earth to be between 4.55 and 4.6 billion years old. Okay, so if this method is reliable and accurate, why the 50 million year discrepancy? That seems like a lot. But let's get into some details here and see what's going on. Keep in mind that there's all kinds of scientific jargon on this topic, and so we'll just present a very straightforward, simplified version of the process. Radiometric dating is the process of estimating the ages of rocks based on the decay of radioactive elements in them. Basically, there are certain kinds of atoms in nature that are unstable and spontaneously decay into other kinds of atoms. For instance, uranium will radioactively decay through a series of steps until it becomes the stable element called lead. The original element is called the parent element, and the end result is called the daughter element. Radioisotope dating is commonly used to date igneous rocks, rocks which formed when hot molten material cooled and solidified. The dating clock started when the rock cooled. During the molten state, it is assumed that the intense heat forced any gaseous daughter elements to escape. It is assumed that once the rock cooled, no more atoms escaped, and any daughter element now found in the rock is a result of radioactive decay since that rock formed. The decay rate is measured in terms of half-life. That is the length of time it takes half of the remaining atoms of a radioactive parent element to decay. Now, of course, that can be measured in a laboratory, and it is assumed that since we know the decay rate, we can calculate backwards and come up with the age of the rock. But is that all there is to it? Here's where it gets tricky. It's true, we can measure a decay rate using observational science, but there's another kind of science that is required to accurately calculate dates for rocks, and that is what we call historical science. Historical science deals with the things in the past, and therefore it cannot be repeated and tested. Dating methods require both types of science, because in order to get accurate rock dates, one would have to accurately know both the decay rate and the initial conditions of the rock sample, right? Since radioisotope dating uses both types of science, we can't directly measure the ages of rocks. There are assumptions involved. For instance, how do we know what the initial conditions were in the rock sample? How do we know the amounts of parent or daughter elements now in that sample haven't been altered by other processes in the past? How does someone know the decay rate has remained constant since the rock formed? The answer is, they don't. Let's simplify here and talk about a typical hourglass. Let's say you walk into a room and you see an hourglass with sand at the top and sand at the bottom, and some sand sprinkling from the top chamber to the bottom. Well, observational science would allow us to see and measure the sand, and then calculate how long the hourglass has been running, right? We could make our sand measurements and then calculate when the hourglass was turned over, right? Well, those calculations could be wrong, because we may have failed to consider some major assumptions, like, was there any sand at the bottom when the hourglass was turned over? Has any sand been added or taken out of the hourglass? Has the sand always been falling at a constant rate? Since we did not observe the initial conditions when the hourglass started, and we haven't been watching the sand all the time since then, we must make assumptions. All three of those assumptions can affect our time calculations. Now, of course, there's more to understanding all of this, but enough said.
So the sand was interesting. Suppose it got, I'm just throwing, this is random stuff, okay? This isn't ultra scientific because I'm not a scientist. Suppose the environment in which the hourglass was became very, very humid. What may happen to that sand? It may clump, and what may stop? The flow may stop, okay? Then what happens if it becomes very, very dry? Then the flow would speed back up. So those are the kinds of points in a very simplified way to say, okay, so radiometric dating, if you didn't catch that, the way I try to understand it the best is rock. Rock has a certain amount of this carbon in it. Over time, that amount of carbon changes, right? We know, we can observe right now how that carbon decays. But what we don't know is how much carbon was really in it when that rock was created, do we? And we also don't know what if in the past, because of atmospheric conditions, what if carbon didn't decay the same way that it does today? Right? Okay? Now, I want you to watch this, because this video is not a creationist. This is just a science guy who makes videos and explains carbon dating. I watch this, and when you get toward the end, maybe write a couple things down, because he says some very revealing things and some very honest things. And he's not a creationist. As far as I know, he's not even a Christian. So I'm going to play this.
Hey there, and welcome to Brain Stuff. I'm Josh Clark, and this is the Brain Stuff where I explain to you how carbon-14 dating works. Carbon-14 dating, which we also just call carbon dating, is a form of radiometric dating. And all it is measuring the decay of a certain type of atom found in a once-living organism to determine when it was last alive. And all of this starts in the upper atmosphere of Earth, where it's constantly bombarded by cosmic rays. And one of the things these cosmic rays do is knock neutrons off of some atoms and protons off of others. And before you know it, the nice, stable, family man nitrogen-14 atom is all wrapped up and gone crazy and becomes what's known as a carbon-14 atom, which is radioactive. Now, carbon-14 atoms aren't the only ones in the upper atmosphere. There's also carbon-12 atoms. Carbon-12 atoms are in much more abundance, and they're pretty stable. Carbon-14 atoms are, again, radioactive and unstable, but they're formed at a reliable, steady rate. So at any point in time, we have a pretty good idea of the ratio of carbon-12 atoms to carbon-14 atoms. Got that? It's important. Now, carbon dioxide is essential to life here on Earth. Plants breathe it in, animals eat the plants, we eat the animals and plants, and these carbon molecules, carbon-14 and 12, that make up the carbon dioxide, get in everything. What's neat is that the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-14 found in all these living things here on Earth is pretty much the same as what's in the atmosphere, which means it's predictable. And some very, very smart scientists have figured out that carbon-14 actually decays at a predictable rate, right? Carbon-14, like all radioactive particles, has what's called a half-life. Now, the half-life is the amount of time it takes for the number of radioactive particles in a sample to decrease by half. Carbon-14 has a half-life of 5,730 years. That means that after 5,730 years, the amount of carbon-14 atoms in a, say, plant that you found fossilized will be half of what it was the last time that plant took, well, a breath of life. After 11,460 years, which is two half-lives, there'll be a quarter the amount of carbon-14 that was originally present. And then after 17,190 years, you'll have just an eighth of the number of carbon-14, and so on, until there's none left. And this is actually one of the limitations of carbon-14 dating, that eventually you're going to go far enough back in time that all of the carbon-14 atoms have decayed. And you don't know whether this took place a day before or 100,000 years before, which means the time limit that you can date things using carbon-14 is roughly 50,000 years. But as long as you are trying to date something that lived on Earth within the last 50,000 years, you can figure out roughly when it was last alive. And the way that you do that is by measuring the rate of decay of carbon-14 atoms compared to the slow and steady carbon-12 atoms that are also present in there. Presto, change-o, you've got some carbon-14 dating, and all of a sudden you say, oh my God, this wooden axe handle is 12,000 years old. Pretty sweet stuff. And this whole thing gets even more interesting when you realize that future archaeologists are going to have a lot of trouble using carbon-14 dating thanks to us, humans of the present time. Our industrial activities have been pumping CO2 into the atmosphere and really messing with the ratio of carbon-12 to carbon-14. And even more astounding, all of the nuclear bombs that we set off in the mid-20th century, well, those messed with the atmospheric ratios too. So good luck with all of that, future anthropologists and archaeologists. Sorry.
Do you get what he just said? He just said, like, what we know right now, based on how we know everything works now, this is how fast carbon decays. But because we are evil polluters destroying the world, we are putting so much, we are changing the atmospheric condition. So in the future, who knows how reliable carbon dating will be? In other words, 1,000 years from now, people won't know what the atmospheric conditions were like today. So, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm going to basically stop there. You get it. You know what I'm saying? It's like...
But the reverse is true, too, because there was no one here to observe what the atmospheric conditions were 10,000 years ago.
Yes, same deal as if you've bought into the environmental and... Of course you do. If you've bought into the environmental climate change hysteria, though... The same thing. It's a hoax that we know, we understand how everything has always worked throughout all of time. We don't. But Eric's right. As Christians, the Lord called us to care for the earth. So we want clean water, we want all that stuff. We don't want to pollute. So anyway, the yes.
Is what
that's the other thing he said. Well, and I'm no geologist or scientist, but the point is, even this gentleman is saying, because of all the atmospheric changes going on now, we don't know how that will affect carbon dating in the future, which just says, because we don't know what conditions were in the past, how could we be so confident in those today? Plus, the other big problem is how far back is carbon dating reliable, did he say? 50,000 years. How old do they say the Earth is? Billions of years old. Now, what they will say is, oh, yes. It's not. That's the point. It's 6,000 to 10,000 years old, based on the Bible. The problem is, if you go back 50,000 years, what they then do is they have to make assumptions. Well, yes, but then we found this rock in a place where the ice shelf melted so fast. But what they're never, whether it's the melting ice or it's the rock formations, it's all assuming that the process that we observe today is exactly how the process has taken place throughout history. And that we just don't know. However, even if carbon dating is reliable for 50,000 years or 60,000 years, as someone say, that is a problem for young Earth creationists because we believe the Earth is 6,000 years old. So, what is the biblical answer? And we'll finish here. What is the biblical answer for an old-looking world? That's important, and you'll see why in this next minute here. Biblical answers for an old-looking world. So these guys would say, well then, okay, whatever, it's still at least 50,000 years old. We say it can't be. Well, based on what we just said, let's give two concepts here. Ready for this question? When God created Adam, how old was he? How old was he? How old was he? It's a trick. I'm tricking you. I'm trying to trick you. How old was Adam when he was created? Yeah, we know how old he was.
He was when he was created, how old was he?
He was 1 day old. Okay, this is a trick question. How old was Adam when he was created? He was 1 day old. But how old did he look if you met him today? Let's say 30 years old, right? Or 40 years old, 20 years old. He was a fully grown man, but how old was he? 1 day old. What came first, the chicken or the egg? You see, you knew I was going to get scientific, okay? What came first, the chicken or the egg? Not a trick question. Well, the chicken came first. How old was the chicken? 1 day old. But it was fully grown. It was mature. When the universe was created, how old was it?
1 day old.
But how did it look? Fully mature. Fully mature. But 1 day old. Yeah, for a lot of the reasons that we saw they said tonight. So you didn't even need to come tonight. You were all set. So first of all, I'll come to you in just a second. Number one, biblical answers, the point one I would put under here is a mature creation. A mature creation. Okay? Same with the stars, right? Well, these stars are a million light years away, so what you're seeing right now is actually a dead star. And in fact, I'm not even looking at Mr. Thompson. I'm seeing Mr. Thompson 0.3 nanoseconds ago in the past, right? Because that's how light works. I don't know how many nanoseconds, but a couple maybe, all right? We see things, and they'll say the stars. So the universe, the only way you could see that star was for it to have erupted 2 million years ago. Well, God knows how stars work because he made them. So in the beginning, God said, let there be light. And there was light. And so he knows how this works. So he didn't create a star that was 1 day old. He created a light that I could see. Because he wanted us to see the stars, right? He created a mature creation. Isabel, what were you going to say? And then I'll go to my very last. It's a good point that God lives outside of time. Lives, and so his creation and his creative power is outside of time. So, very good point. Right. Yes. Okay. All right, I'm not sure I follow 100%, but I see where you're going with that. Last thing I want to give you is it's a mature creation. But there's another thing that can account for things like, well, the carbon decays at this rate, but which changes. The last thing that could account for some of these questions we see is a cataclysmic event. What is a cataclysmic event? Well, things like hurricanes, things like earthquakes and tornadoes and things like asteroids, and now help me finish this here, and things like, what, Deborah? Floods, yeah. Things like floods. Things like really, really big floods. It's just like when they say, well, the Grand Canyon was formed over, okay? Because the Colorado River would take this long to form the canyon. Well, they're making an assumption. What is the assumption that they're making? That the Colorado River formed the canyon. We don't know that the Colorado River formed the canyon. Okay? A cataclysmic event. And even to this day, cataclysmic events cause canyon-like formations and things like that. Exactly. As things like the flood are mocked and derided by people, well, actually, sometimes it does happen overnight. That's the point of the flood, is that a huge, intense event can change things. So when you look at it, so you could look at this evidence and say, wow, look at all of these things and these fossils mixed in. Why do we see fish over here and why do we see that? And the evolution says, well, because millions of years ago, the fish lived here and then turned into the land creature. Okay. Or you could say, well, in the most reliable manuscript that we've ever been handed, there's an account of a worldwide flood. And that would be the reason why you see whales where there are no seas. Why you find these things there. But an evolutionist is invested in the theory, is personally invested that there has to be millions of years, it has to be true. So when you look at the evidence, they have to say, well, obviously, the fish lived here when the sea was here. And it morphed into... you know how it goes. So anyhow, if Bill Nye the Science Guy were here, he would make fun a lot of the things that I'm saying because I'm probably not explaining them well. I don't claim to be a scientist. I'm just giving you the layman's concept of these things, and people much more smarter than me, Those people, you can find all kinds of great research and actual scientific documentation on all of these things. And I'd encourage you to study that out. And the last word, maybe, goes to Isabel. Clismic. Sure. Yet you see those things, but we know that that's not how the Grand Canyon came. But that gives you an event that you can, yeah. If a lot of water can make a difference. So we'll leave the great scientific statement right there. A lot of water can make a difference, okay? And we'll end right there. And we'll talk about the flood, actually, next week. I think he's going to talk about the flood, so...